This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
How was work today, dear? Would you believe more people are saying, not bad? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 6th. Good to have you with us. People are pretty happy with their jobs these days. At least that's the headline from the Conference Board's annual job satisfaction report out today. Almost 63% of workers said they were satisfied, the highest rate since the survey began nearly 40 years ago. Dig beneath the headline, though, and folks are less pleased with specific parts of their jobs, including wages, benefits, workloads, and that ever-elusive work-life balance. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
Ask people a question like, are you happy with your job? And these days, most say yes. Alan Schweier at the Conference Board says this year,
overall job satisfaction was up for the 13th year in a row.
But only slightly. And if you start digging deeper and asking people how they feel about things like wages, workplace culture, and work-life balance at their job, there are signs people are increasingly dissatisfied.
Last year, wages were more influential on job satisfaction than anything else. And this year, other factors like culture, the relationship with the supervisor, the people you work with, things like that came up higher this year.
People who switched jobs in the last few years are more likely to be dissatisfied with work than those who stayed put, which Schweier says is a big shift.
People may have left jobs during the pandemic because earlier on there were big wage gains to be had. And maybe people didn't think about some of the other elements.
Like workplace culture and opportunities for growth. A lot of people were also hired remotely and are now being required to start coming into an office, which not everyone is happy about. William Vanderblumen, who runs an executive search firm, says that may also be partly why people are putting more emphasis on workplace culture these days.
When you force people back into the office and they're making a commute, all of a sudden they're now paying attention to, I need to have a place that I want to go to.
Plus, he says, we just went through a major crisis, a global pandemic.
You have people coming out of that really driven by something more than just getting through Monday to Friday.
These days, John Higgins at the think tank, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, says people are rethinking what they want out of work.
The focus on work as just something that you do to earn a living has changed for a lot of people, and much more people are more interested in a job that gives them some type of satisfaction.
And he says those kinds of jobs can be hard to find. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Wall Street was pretty satisfied today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Europe this week. Today he met with the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, and the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. The conversation they had is one that the U.S. has had with China as well, about overcapacity, the idea that China is flooding the world with underpriced products, something China denies. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Overcapacity is kind of a fuzzy word, and that's saying a lot for an economic term. Jeffrey Gertz is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security.
At a basic level, overcapacity is really just too much production and too little demand.
It's the idea that a country has subsidized or propped up its industries so much that they're drowning in products. Ilaria Matsoko is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
And therefore, you tend to have a surge of exports, often at a lower cost, that are undermining basically industries elsewhere.
This is what the U.S. and Europe are saying that China is doing with electric vehicles and a lot of other industries related to clean energy, flooding countries with leftovers and potentially justifying U.S. and European retaliation.
I think it's an excuse for protectionism.
Nicholas Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says when it comes to electric vehicles, there isn't overcapacity. China's just better at making them, and the U.S. and Europe are bitter, which is basically what China says, too.
They got started in the industry earlier. They're far and away the largest market. The very successful firms such as BYD, remember, Warren Buffett invested in BYD more than a decade ago. He saw this coming.
But Jeffrey Gertz at the Center for a New American Security says it's not just about electric cars. China does pump up its manufacturers with cheap credit and tax benefits, and that's messing with international markets, he says.
Chinese companies may be operating at a loss for a very long time, but are not necessarily incentivized to exit the market as would otherwise happen. You have just kind of a continual sort of excess reserve, as it were, of production, and you are incentivized to continue producing even if the market is telling you there's no need for it.
Overcapacity is a problem that has been identified by the Chinese government itself in official reports going back a decade, says Jeremy Chan, senior analyst at the Eurasia Group.
Now that Beijing has signaled in the last 6 weeks or so that overcapacity doesn't really exist, that it's some sort of a myth now concocted by the West when it wasn't a myth in the government work report 2 months ago, I think that we're headed towards a darker or more difficult place.
Expect more trade restrictions from Europe and possibly the U.S. because what was a debatable economic question has now entered the world of politics. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We have talked on this show about how climate change is upending the insurance market in many places, making it harder for homeowners to find policies they can afford. In California, where wildfires have cost billions of dollars in property damage, most private insurers are no longer offering new policies at all. Some proposed regulations in the state are aimed at enticing insurers to stick around. But California is hardly the only state facing these issues. Dave Jones is the former state insurance commissioner of California. He's now director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley School of Law. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Amy.
How would you describe the property insurance market in California right now?
It's under duress. What's happening is that as climate change has driven more frequent and severe weather-related events, it's killing people, damaging property, and causing more insurance losses. And insurers respond in two ways. One is they raise price, and the other is they stop writing insurance. And both those things are happening in California.
Now, in the past, insurance companies in California have not been able to use catastrophe modeling to set rates. The last state to not allow that. Why was that, and how is that changing?
So under current California law, the way that rates are set is by looking at past experience. But insurers are now arguing that with climate change and the fact that the natural catastrophic events are becoming nonlinear and increasingly unpredictable, that they ought to be allowed to use probabilistic models or catastrophe models to help set those rates. It is important to note that Florida has allowed probabilistic modeling for many, many years, has allowed reinsurance costs to be included in its rates, has rates three or four times the national average, has limited third-party lawsuits, has done a number of things the insurers have asked for some time. And yet what we've seen is 12 or so insurance companies go insolvent. The Florida insurer of last resort, Florida Citizens, has about 1.3 million policyholders. These are people that can't get private admitted insurance. So California is considering allowing cap models to be used and allowing reinsurance costs to be included in rates. And that might help in the short or midterm, but I'm concerned that we're not going to be able to rate our way out of this problem.
When you say we're not going to be able to rate our way out of this problem, what do you mean by that? And what do you see as some solutions?
So the insurers are arguing that if they're given more rates or they're able to have higher prices and collect more premium, that they'll write more insurance. And in the shorter midterm, giving insurers more premium may help. But in the long term, it's likely to be overwhelmed by the increased risk and losses driven by climate change. And so you reach a point at which, even at a higher price, it's simply not profitable for the insurance company to write insurance. And that may very well be where we are in Florida and may very well be where we're going to get in other parts of the country over time.
So does the state end up picking up more of the bill? I mean, already more and more homeowners are finding themselves relegated to the state insurer of last resort, both in Florida and California, and other states are building these programs as well.
So there are 37 states that have what are called FAIR plans, Fair Access to Insurance Requirements, which are basically involuntary associations of insurance companies that are established by state law that are required to write insurance for those risks that the private insurers have decided it's too risky to write. FAIR plans rates, though, are typically required to be set based on risk. And since they're insuring the most challenging risks, their rates are even higher oftentimes than the private market. And so that is where I think things are going to go. And then we're going to see increasing numbers of people that simply can't afford that and maybe having to go without insurance.
I think when I talk to folks who've had their premiums go way up, there's this impression that insurance companies are just protecting their profits and that they're raking in money. Are these companies hurting as much as they claim?
So I think it depends upon the particular market that they're in, the particular state that they're in. But there's no question that in California, for example, in 2017 and 2018, when we had the severe catastrophic wildfires, that they had substantial losses in the area of $15 billion each year. That far exceeded the premium they were collecting that year. Although in subsequent years, the premium they've collected has been sufficient to cover their losses. So, you know, they're not magicians. At the end of the day, insurers are seeking to make profits and they're going to try to price or limit their exposure accordingly. And that's what's going on.
So what do you see as some solutions to this problem if we can't just rate our way out of it, as you said?
So first and foremost, we have to move faster and more aggressively to transition from fossil fuels, which are the major contributor to greenhouse gases that are driving climate change. Second, we need to make more investments in mitigation at the property, community, and landscape level. But we also need to make sure that insurance models account for that. And that's currently not the case. And so that will probably require state legislation, certainly as in California, to make sure that insurers are accounting for these mitigation efforts. Third, as more people are thrown onto FAIR plans, each state's going to have to look at ways to shore up its FAIR plan. Some ideas include giving FAIR plans the ability to sell catastrophe bonds or other bonds as a way of raising capital. There are other suggestions as well to try to make sure that the FAIR plans are better likely to be able to have sufficient funds to pay out in the event of catastrophic events.
Dave Jones is director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley School of Law and former Insurance Commissioner of California. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amy.
Dave Jones mentioned catastrophe bonds as part of the solution. The team and I from our podcast, How We Survive, did a deep dive on cat bonds and the troubled Florida insurance market. You can listen to that on our website, marketplace.org, or wherever you go for podcasts. coming up.
There were people everywhere. People were spending money everywhere. Every bar in town was open. I mean, there were several places even to stop and eat.
Sounds like the place to be. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 176 points, just shy of 0.5%, to close at 38,852. The NASDAQ added 192 points, 1.2%, to end at 16,349. And the S&P 500 picked up 52 points, a little over 1%, to finish at 5180. $2.1 trillion. That's the peak amount of excess savings Americans accumulated during the pandemic, according to a couple of economists at the San Francisco Fed. We hit that number in August of 2021, and it's been downhill ever since. Now the same economists say it's all gone, and that, in fact, our savings are a bit below the pre-pandemic level. The FAA has opened another investigation into Boeing, according to the Wall Street Journal. The paper reports that the plane maker has told the aviation regulator that employees may have skipped some inspections on some 787 Dreamliners. Boeing descended 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Way back in time, okay, about 8 years ago, Uber, the ride-sharing company, made a big splash with a research paper that envisioned a world where people could hop into small electric aircraft in big cities and fly over traffic, cutting time off of their commutes. I mean, haven't we all dreamed about doing that? Since then, though, a whole bunch of companies have sprouted up with the aim of making that vision a reality by developing electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, eVTOLs for short. All of them will need to clear a big hurdle, certification from the Federal Aviation Administration. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
Kyle Clark steps onto the manufacturing floor of his company's brand new production facility in South Burlington, Vermont. He's the founder and CEO of the electric aircraft manufacturer Beta Technologies.
We've got people over here building the structures of the aircraft, on the far side building the battery and propulsion, and upstairs in all the clean rooms building the sensitive electronic components.
And in a far corner of this hangar-like room, there's a dark gray prototype of the electric aircraft that Beta's developing. It looks kind of like two big drones carrying a futuristic minivan with a propeller on the back. The finished version will be gleaming white.
So what you're looking at here right now is actually a complete mock-up that's been put together and torn apart numerous times.
As the company tries to work out the exact instructions for how to assemble one of them, the fact that Beta has gotten to this point in about 7 years is a testament both to how fast the eVTOL industry has developed and how far it still has to go. Matthew Clark is a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, no relation to Kyle Clark. He compares the industry's progress to a loading bar on an old computer. It started out moving really fast.
It was like, zhoop, and then we're here.
Here, he says, is about 80%.
And it's going to stick there for a long time until it gets to 100%.
That's because that last 20% includes the huge hurdle of getting the okay from regulators to manufacture, sell, and fly these futuristic electric aircraft.
And this is an insanely rigorous process that has only gotten more rigorous in recent years.
Elon Head is senior editor of the aviation industry publication The Air Current. She says the certification process is rigorous because the FAA wants to ensure these aircraft are safe.
Which is difficult to do when you have a lot of new technology that doesn't have a long track record that you can point to for determinations about reliability.
And getting through the FAA's hurdles is expensive. A few years ago, funding wasn't a problem. Some eVTOL companies went public during the booming market of 2021. Others, including Beta, got private investments and government grants. But we're in a different investment landscape now, Head says.
The higher interest rates has, you know, given investors more things to do with their money versus invest them in flying cars.
And getting through certification is proving more costly than some companies expected. Matthew Clark at the University of Illinois says the reality is
most of these companies don't have that financial backing to get through that certification hurdle.
And that means out of the hundreds of companies in the sector, Clark expects that most won't make it.
And I think what is going to happen is that they're going to have a few companies, maybe 5 to 10, that actually have viable business products.
Beta Technologies in Vermont is hoping it's one of them. But its first aircraft won't be a self-flying air taxi that takes off like a helicopter. CEO Kyle Clark says about a year ago, the company decided to start with certifying the prototype in its factory, an electric aircraft that just takes off and lands like a normal plane and mostly carries cargo.
I think maybe it's a Yankee pragmatism.
Beta already has deals to sell their planes to UPS and other companies. Eventually, it does envision making a vertical takeoff and landing vehicle to carry people.
So we end up at the same place. And my contention is that by taking this stepwise approach and generating trust within the public and the FAA, we actually end up at the finish line faster.
And perhaps with a bit more cash on hand. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
The classic story of the boom-bust economy has played out in towns across the West. A mining company discovers a valuable vein of coal, or an energy developer starts tapping into a store of natural gas. And suddenly, the town is happening. Workers with good-paying jobs are flush with cash, and the community suddenly has money for libraries, roads, or recreation centers. But what happens to all those community resources when the boom is over? From Southern Wyoming, Will Walkie reports.
At the recreation center in Hanna, Wyoming, John Ostling shows me a big, empty swimming pool. There's no water here, just a slide that leads to hard concrete. The white paint on the side of the pool is chipping away.
Right now we're scraping, you know, to get ready to paint it. Even though we may not use it, it's not necessary for us to make it look in disrepair.
Ostling is the mayor of Hanna, a town of around 700 on the remote High Plains. The closest city, if you can call it that, is Laramie, 70 miles away. and Hannah is struggling to keep this recreation center open. It's huge and expensive.
Yeah, last year we had 1 month. I think one of our gas bills was $12,000.
The entire town has a budget of just a few million dollars. Maintaining the rec center costs around $300,000 a year. It has a racquetball court, sauna, weight rooms, and a sports court that doubles as event space. But fewer than 40 residents pay to be members.
And what the town has done over the years to maintain this is actually we haven't put money in streets. We haven't put money on other services.
In recent years, the rec center has decreased hours to keep costs down, but that hasn't cut it. It's a tough reality for a community that once supported facilities like this and much more. Hannah started off as a company town, and hundreds of millions of tons of coal have been mined around here. Valcorco Black is a local rancher and remembers Hannah in the 1980s.
There were people everywhere. People were spending money everywhere. Every bar in town was open. I mean, there were several places even to stop and eat.
The school added temporary modular classrooms. There was a bowling alley, soda fountain, and movie theater. This happens a lot in energy towns. The mining or oil and gas economy booms, and local leaders think, what should we build to attract more workers and their families? Back in the 80s, when Hannah's tax coffers were flush and coal companies had money to give, the town built the rec center.
They'd have the pool open for the kids all day long, and you were there from 10 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. Yeah.
But almost as quickly as things went up, things went down. As the mines gradually shut down, the town's population dwindled. Another local, Pam Paulson, says when the job opportunities dried up, a lot of workers just bailed.
Some of them, they just left their keys on the counter and walked out the door.
Today, Hannah is mostly a bedroom community and a quiet place to retire cheap. And the recreation center is a huge headache. Not just paying staff to, say, wipe down the gym equipment, but the huge cost of heating the sprawling facility. But Hannah's mayor, John Ostling, doesn't want to close it, even if it's expensive. He says it's critical for the health of the community.
Let's get the public forum started.
This spring, he led a town meeting to talk about ways to save the rec center. He has looked into federal grants, adding solar panels. There's an old mine shaft under the facility. There's even talk about tapping into that again to burn coal for heat. Resident Rose Dabbs had an idea to attract more members.
Have you tried sending out a flyer saying what the prices are to draw the people in?
Someone else in the back yelled, give Bill Gates a call. Resident Jim Noah was wondering about the wind energy companies nearby.
Is there any way to try talking them into donating electricity to us?
The town council postponed closing the rec center, even though there is no solution at this point. The main thing keeping the facility open right now is the hope that something will turn around. In Hannah, Wyoming, I'm Will Walkie for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the real estate brokerage Redfin says low-income Americans made up a smaller share of home buyers last year, taking out about 20% of mortgages, down from 23% in 2020. That's thanks to both higher prices and higher mortgage rates. In other housing news, the same Redfin has agreed to pay $9.25 million to settle lawsuits alleging that brokerage firms and the National Association of Realtors conspired to inflate real estate commissions. In a filing with the SEC, the company said the settlement does not concede or validate any of the claims asserted against us. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Elise Hassan, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work. while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.